Welcome to Face the Nation. I'm Leslie Stahl. We have two major news stories developing this morning. U.S. warplanes conducted a raid against Syrian positions in Lebanon overnight. At least two American planes were shot down. Also, there's been a tentative agreement in the Greyhound bus strike. We'll begin our broadcast with a report on the air raid in Lebanon from Pentagon correspondent Bill Lynch. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Leslie. While U.S. reconnaissance aircraft have been flying missions over Syrian positions in Lebanon since September and have occasionally been fired upon, today was the first use of offensive American air power in Lebanon. President Reagan ordered that retaliatory strike after two F-14 reconnaissance planes came under heavy Syrian fire yesterday, and this morning some two dozen strike aircraft from the carriers Independence and Kennedy streaked in to attack Syrian gun and missile emplacements in the hills east of Beirut. Two of the Navy planes were shot down. Lebanese forces rescued Commander Edward Andrews from the sea off Beirut when his A-7 was hit, but the two-man crew of a downed A-6E is still officially unaccounted for, although Defense Secretary Weinberger said in Paris this morning that they parachuted behind Syrian lines and are believed to be in Syrian hands. He said their release will be negotiated. Presumably, today's retaliatory strikes set a precedent, sending Syria a message that any future attacks on American planes will bring an automatic U.S. retaliation.
Thank you, Bill. The Greyhound bus strike may be over soon. A tentative agreement was announced last night by a federal mediator.
Based on recommendations made by me for settlement of the dispute, both parties have agreed to that settlement. The Greyhound Council of the Union Council voted by an overwhelming majority to accept that proposal, and they will send out to their membership a ballot with a strong recommendation that the people vote yes for the proposal.
Labor leaders saw the bus strike as a last stand against a rising tide of union busting. Who won and who lost in the battle? We'll ask the head of Greyhound and a union president. Is the de-unionizing of America inevitable? We'll ask author Studs Terkel, social forecaster John Nesbitt, and a lawyer who advises companies on how to keep the unions out. Is the labor movement dying? An issue facing the nation.
From CBS News, Washington, Face the Nation with White House correspondent Leslie Stahl.
The pattern is becoming familiar. The company says the times are hard, and instead of a raise, union workers will have to accept pay cuts and other concessions or lose their jobs. In the Greyhound case, the drivers fought the concessions with a mean and nasty strike, deciding to leave the driving to somebody else. But 60,000 unemployed workers applied for the strikers' jobs. And so last night, the union's leaders agreed to concessions. How many is not yet known. As with the steel, auto, and airline industries, Greyhound claims the cuts are necessary in order to compete in these times when automation, deregulation, and foreign competition are changing the rules of the game. The unions say President Reagan set the tone for the new labor wars when he fired the Air Traffic Controllers Union 2 years ago. But in truth, labor's trouble started long before that. After World War II, 35% of the workforce was in unions. Today, 23%. And the public perceives the unions as greedy. Joining me now are Frank Najat, chairman of Greyhound Lines, and William Wimpesinger, president of the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers. Mr. Najat, Greyhound, your company, has been saying all along throughout this strike that if the workers didn't take substantial pay cuts and make other concessions, that your company simply couldn't compete. You've reached a tentative agreement. Is that what the workers have agreed to, substantial pay cuts and other concessions?
Leslie, because of an agreement between the company and the union bargainers, I can't describe or get into the details of the agreement.
Well, characterize it for us.
Well, let me say this. It's sufficiently close to what we feel we need to keep this company going. And I'm confident that when our employees have a chance to look at the proposed agreement in the sanctity of their own homes and give it some considered judgment, that they will ratify. And in fact, their leadership has committed itself to overwhelming support of this proposal. They believe, too, it should be ratified.
There are concessions, I assume.
Obviously.
They are. Would you characterize them as substantial? Are workers in your company and therefore probably in other companies just going to have to face the fact that pay cuts in this era are inevitable?
I'd rather not characterize them. I think each employee has to determine that in his own situation. But I would say that as part of yours, in response to the second part of your question, I do believe that that ours is not the only situation like this that exists in the country today, particularly in the transportation industry. There are going to be, have already been, and there are going to be other companies that are going to have to do the same thing, because you cannot run a company when the money you're taking in doesn't equal or exceed the money you're paying out. It's that simple.
Did you win?
Nobody wins in a strike, but I don't feel like I was defeated.
You don't. How soon do you think that your company can get back to full service?
Well, we will get back to full service within a few days after the ratification, if it is ratified. But it's our intent, though, to continue to operate as we have been until the date the vote is taken.
What about all the new people you hired? What happens to them now? Do they go out of your company? Do they stay in?
No, they will be employees of our company, but their status, again, is one of the items that's included in the proposed offer, and I'm not at liberty to discuss it.
You can't even tell those workers? I know that the other workers keep their jobs. Your drivers keep their jobs, but you can't tell the
Leslie,
newly hired?
I'd love to, Leslie, but I want to honor the commitment we made to the union people. I'm sure they'll keep it, and I want to keep it.
Okay. Mr. Wimpesinger, you represent the machinists. They were not the union that struck, but you honored the strike. What do you think this means for the rest of labor in the country? Unions have been saying this was a turning point, a watershed for unions.
Well, I get a little concerned at the way we characterize some of these situations. You know, it's clear that for many years there was substantial worker progress at the bargaining tables of this country, primarily because when bargaining was finally legitimized in this society in the 1930s, basically, workers had a lot of problems, and it wasn't therefore strange that those problems were given treatment at the bargaining table. And it's therefore not strange to me, many years later, when employers are alleging that they have some problems, and it therefore will surface at the bargaining table, because most Americans don't understand that collective bargaining from its very inception has been nothing other than a problem-solving device.
Well,
your
union is striking still against Continental Airlines.
And we will continue until we get it settled.
Well, all workers now are making concessions. In every big industry where there are problems, not willing to face that right now?
That is balderdash. That is the most outrageous misconception that's abroad in this land today. We have over 12,000 collective agreements in force throughout our jurisdiction, which is United States, Canada, and possessions. And 11,000 will be settled without any unhappiness, without any disruptions
from
anybody.
But with concessions?
And no! Heavens no! We have an outstanding record in avoiding concessions. And it's only because the parties to the agreement can negotiate something with which each of them can live.
Mr. Najat, do you agree with that?
I'm glad to hear Mr. Wimpesinger say that. I hope he's speaking the same way that all of the other members of the AFL-CIO would. The arrests that were made proved out to be about three-quarters of the arrests made were for people who were not ground employees. There were people who were persuaded to come in and demonstrate by the AFL-CIO. So I'm glad to hear Bill talking this way. I'd like to believe that the leadership is going to be responsible enough not to encourage that kind of activity.
There's something basically immoral, too, about the notion that because one or two highly visible enterprises in a collective bargaining situation extract, by the use of power, financial power, extract concessions from workers, every other employer in the country automatically lines up and says, me too, whether he's making a profit, whether he needs it or not, and whether or not he has employees who'll agree with it.
Is there a deliberate move to bust the unions, do you think?
In many quarters, I think there is. I think it's one of the top agenda items of the business roundtable of this country, and they meet in secret, so you don't really know what they're up to until you see the results. You watch their hands and not their mouths, and you begin to get the scenario filled in that there is a conscious attempt to take us on and beat us.
I think it'd be an exercise in futility.
It'd be an exercise in futility.
Certainly
you
would
don't
be.
Think that unions can be broken?
Absolutely
even in this
not.
Time of unemployment?
Not without, when you say broken, no. And I think any businessman who sets out to break one is crazy. But I do think unions can be taken on when there's an economic reason to preserve the investment of your shareholders.
60,000 unemployed workers applied for jobs at Greyhound.
Mm-hmm. And I hope that in the settlement, that they are all displaced. Those that were hired are displaced because it's customary in this country when scabs take employment and work behind picket lines that they're gone when it's over.
What? We can't get any word on what's going to happen to those workers.
But I don't know when a scab becomes legitimate. If he joins the union, is he no longer a scab?
Is the law working,
Mr. Depends on the circumstances all the way around, obviously. But
is the law working, the labor laws in this country? I've heard some labor leaders charge that the Reagan administration is not enforcing the law to help
unions. That's absolutely true. You should look at the performance of the National Labor Relations Board. Look at the people that he appointed to the board. The National Right to Work for Less Committee, one of the most virulently anti-union organizations in the country, has one of their lawyers appointed to administer the labor laws of the country when that bias is manifest in his whole professional career. That's tantamount to putting a convicted felon on a Supreme Court.
We both would have... I'm not going to sit here and defend President Reagan or his administration, but I can tell you that with the experience we've just had in our dispute, we found that there are a good many jurisdictions, city, state, and others, which feel that they cannot afford the protection that we as citizens, every one of us, regardless of what side we take on a labor issue, we are entitled to protection. We're entitled to the police and other authorities making everyone obey the law, whether they're strikers or not. And that didn't happen in every instance. In most cases, it was wonderful the way they protected our people. A few cases, it was much less than wonderful.
Thank you, gentlemen. We have run out of time. I'm sorry, but we will be back in a moment with other views on the union movement.
The following is presented by the National Urban League.
You know, Roberts, it wasn't my idea to hire you. I'm not in business to do favors. I got buildings to put up. Oh, I took you on, sure, but I never hired a black man before, and I didn't really think you could cut it.
Too often in today's society, people are judged solely by the color of their skin rather than by what they can do. But when people are given a chance to make something of themselves, there's no limit to what they can do.
But Roberts, you're doing a great job, and starting Monday, I know you're going to be a great foreman.
All I ever needed was a chance.
Everybody deserves a chance to make it on their own, regardless of race, creed, color, or sex. The Urban League is dedicated to achieving that, and you can help by opening your heart and your mind and giving someone that chance. To find out exactly what you can do, write National Urban League, 500 East 62nd Street, New York, New York, 10021. A public service message of this station, the Urban League, and the Advertising Council.
With me now are John Nesbitt, author of a book on future trends in society, Stephen Cabot, an anti-union management consultant, and in New York, Studs Terkel, author of a book on working. We'll start the questioning with Mr. Terkel in New York. Do you think that there is a national management conspiracy to bust or break the unions?
There doesn't have to be a conspiracy. I wish it were as simple as that. No, the climate is set, and the climate, of course, set by the most outrageous anti-labor administration within memory. And so we have not apple blossom time, but certainly union busting time.
Yeah, but the public seems to be behind. It's not just the administration, isn't
that true? That's precisely the point. I think there's been a lobotomy performed down through the years as far as unions and labor are concerned, ever since World War II. And it's changed. As big business become more sophisticated, the person of Mr. Cabot, say, in contrast to a guy Henry Ford hired in the 30s to fight UAW, Harry Bennett, who would hire thugs and ex-cons with baseball bats to bust the heads of picketers. Today you have smiling three-piece suit guys doing the same job, so much more sophisticated. And the result, the young members of the workforce have no idea how the minimum wage came to be. They think it came as an apple in the hand of Eve in the Garden of Eden. It was bloodied heads that did it, and guys were blacklisted, and so minimum wage came to be, and that's under attack today. There's definitely a union-busting climate, no doubt in my mind.
Mr. Cabot, did you hear what Studs Terkel just said about you? He compared you to the thugs of days gone by. Are you a union buster?
No, I'm not, Leslie, and I think that it's about time in our society to look at the real issues. I don't believe I'm any more a union buster than perhaps Mr. Wipsinger and the other members of the AFL-CIO, because they struck Greyhound lines, would like to be considered a company buster.
Yeah, but you do go into companies and you advise them how to keep unions out or how to get them out. Now, you admit that.
Well, I think you're mischaracterizing what I do. I am an attorney that represents management to provide management their legal and practical and strategical options. In some cases, it is to represent companies who desire to maintain their non-union status. In other cases, it's to represent companies like Greyhound, who wish to know their rights when a union strikes a particular company.
But also you work to keep unions out.
Yes, I do. If that is what the company's objective is, and the union seeks to organize.
What do you tell the companies to do?
In what context?
Well, for example, I heard that you tell them to hire a lot of women because women don't like unions, and not to hire blacks because blacks do like unions.
Oh, I think that, Leslie, is poppycock, in all due respect. I think we have to look at the people who are in the working...
Well, it may be poppycock, but is it true?
It's not true.
You don't tell them to hire a lot of women and not to hire blacks?
I do not. I do not. What I do suggest is that management pay attention, careful attention, to the hiring process, to hire people who will be compatible to company's objectives, but in terms of specifically zeroing in and saying women, blacks, old, young, that's ridiculous.
John Nesbitt, you forecast the future. Your crystal ball, what's going to happen to unions? Are they obsolete, becoming obsolete?
Well, I think the evidence suggests that we're moving toward an almost union-free society. This was not started by Ronald Reagan. This has been going on for a long time. You know, the United States was never very unionized, certainly by European standards. The film clip said 35%. I think it was really more like 32% at the height of the industrial period. Then it started to slide. It went down through 20% a few years ago. Today, the private sector, only 16% of the workforce is unionized. And in the economically dynamic South and West, only about 7 or 8% is unionized. I'm just being descriptive here of what's been occurring for a long time. That's the context. There are about 85% of the people in this country are working, are not members of unions in the private sector.
And it's moving fast in that direction.
It's moving very fast in that direction, and will continue to move there unless unions reconceptualize what their role is in the society, unless that changes.
Studs, what would happen if we had no unions in the United States? What kind of a society do you think we'd
become? It would be, very simply, a fink society. Let's be honest about it. Let's call things by their proper name. Union-free is a wrong phrase. I admire Mr. Nesbitt. It'd be scab and frauled. This is the way it was. How did unions come to be and why'd they come to be? What chance does an individual workman or workwoman have against a conglomerate? Who's kidding whom? It's Muhammad Ali in his prime in the same ring with the flyweight and said, let the best man win.
But
that's why
saying,
unions came to be in the first place.
You're talking as if we used to all be unionized and we're talking about not being unionized. There are very few people in this country that are unionized today.
I agree.
84%, and they are not 84% of the working force of this country are not finks.
I agree with you. Of course, that's the sad part of it. I think it's because we have to go deeper in things. Beyond Reagan, I agree. We're anti-historical. We have no sense of past. This applies to every aspect of our lives, and certainly a labor past. We have no idea how people got whatever they have, union conditions or minimum wage, how it came to be. And once you have this no sense of past, born yesterday, not even yesterday, there is no yesterday, you're bound to have this.
I'm surprised at you. I'm surprised you don't give the workers of our country enough credit. The workers in the 80s, and don't confuse and talk about the 30s, we're not in the 30s, we're in the 1980s. And the workers today are brighter and more independent than ever before. And they're not going to take any baloney from management any more or less than they're going to be misled or take baloney from labor unions. And if we take a look at that worker, and management needs that worker in order to survive, in order for all of us to survive. And if we're going to expect to be competitive in our society and have productive workers, then it's an absolute non sequitur to say that that worker is going to be abused by management. On the contrary, management's going to have to treat that worker better than ever before, with or without a labor union, in order to be competitive today.
Let me ask you about an article that appeared recently in the Atlantic Monthly. It talked about the new kind of worker, the key punch operator, the typist, the fast food operator, who is not unionized, but who has no road to promotion. But this is the wave of the future for jobs, high-intensity jobs. The article said that without unions, those workers are destined to remain low-paid, and that society will become further and further polarized with a bunch of low-paid workers and their bosses, high-paid workers, and no middle class, no people to go out and buy the goods that American business is making, and therefore there won't be a middle class. Do you think that could happen, Studs?
Well, that's a possibility. I'd like to just comment on Mr. Cabot. I find that I'm delighted that you respect the intelligence of working people. I do, too. But intelligence also concerns an awareness of history itself. And if people, no matter how intelligent they are, deprived of certain aspects of our background and life, they're bound to be taken now and then. By the way, I want to correct you, Leslie. I never referred to Mr. Cabot as a thug. On the contrary, he's charming and handsome and wears a three-piece suit. And that's the big difference between the 30s and now. Much more sophisticated. Big business has learned many things. Labor has lagged in that respect.
Can somebody talk, though, about the possibility that without unions, there will not be a middle class in this country? Mr. Nesbitt, do you see that as a problem?
Well, I think that's also holding it in either or. We're in the beginning of a new economy, a whole new period. We've been changing economies. This is not a recovery. This is the new economy overtaking the old. And much of the unions are in the old industrial economy, and that will continue to slide. And that's one of the reasons union membership, as a function of the workforce, will continue to go down. We're in a period of working all this out, just as we were when we started the industrial. But, you know, a lot of farmers in this country came to the cities when we changed to an industrial economy, and they took less pay. And it was the unions that helped crank that pay up. I think there are going to be other instrumentalities this time around.
By
the
way,
there is a serious misconception that I'm hearing, and that is the idea of polarization, management making a lot, workers not. I think we have to look at the reality of the situation. The idea that workers or management should expect to give or take every year, and it's automatic, is absolute ludicrousness. It's ridiculous. We have to look at what people get or don't get by whether or not the company is competitive and productive and able to afford to give whatever it can give. It cannot do what companies did in the 60s and the 70s by giving, passing on to the consumer, mortgaging its present in the hope of borrowing to pay. That is destined to produce another recession and probably even worse unless we learn from our mistakes.
Studs, what about the argument that workers are simply overprivileged and this is just a balancing out period?
Oh, of course, this is part of the myth. This is part of the legend of our day. And this, again, is a question of good public relations on one side and not on the other. And history really not being dug into. Of course, that's nonsense. We know that working people today have a rough time, very much indeed, just as I think recovery talk is hype talk from what we've seen. And this is part of the myth of our day. Example, we're just close to
Studs,
a settlement.
I'm sorry, we are fast running out of time.
Wow.
I'm very sorry. I'm sorry, gentlemen. Thank you for being with us. We will be back with some opinions from around the country. The Greyhound strike made the nation's editorial pages this week. From West Virginia, the Charleston Gazette. Companies have a moral duty to protect employees who've given their working lives to the business. An impartial inquiry is needed to determine if Greyhound is doing so. But the Augusta Chronicle in Georgia said that Greyhound had to act as it did in order to survive. Greyhound had only one choice in the face of strikers who were making demands which could have destroyed their employer's ability to compete. Lewis Haber of the South Bend Tribune.
Companies have become amalgamated, become merged with larger companies. The headquarters have moved. And the people who are at home, though, and who we as the newspaper, anyway, would like to think have the community interest at heart in the labor management equation is now labor.
And here's Pat Murphy of the Arizona Republic in Phoenix, headquarters for Greyhound.
We believe the strikers are in error. They're wrong. That in this day and age, when the pressure's on for more productivity.
And the editorial cartoonists are hounding both sides in the bus strike. Thank you for being with us. I'm Leslie Stahl. Have a good week.
This has been Face the Nation with CBS News White House correspondent Leslie Stahl. The topic of today's broadcast was the future of the union movement in America. Correspondent Stahl's guests were Frank Najat, chairman of Greyhound Lines, William Wimpesinger, president of the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, John Nesbitt, author of Megatrends, writer Studs Terkel, whose material includes a book on working, and Stephen Cabot, a management consultant. Executive producer of Face the Nation is Jonathan Ward. The producer is Joan Barone. The broadcast is directed by Robert Vitarelli. Associate producers Karen Shagrew and Kevin McCarthy. Face the Nation originated in Washington, D.C. and is a recorded production of CBS News.